This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. How can what is known as open data, data available to the public, make local government more transparent, responsive, and effective? Here in Chattanooga, the city's answer can be found at its Office of Performance Management and Open Data, where, by the way, they are now hiring. Andrew Savigny is performance analyst there, and Tim Moreland is deputy administrator of the city's Department of Delivery, Innovation, and Performance. Tim, Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Tell us more about the office and the city of Chattanooga's commitment to open data.
The city's commitment to open data started in the previous administration with an executive order that Mayor Andy Burke signed. They kind of started us off on this open data journey that instituted our open data platform. So if folks don't know, you can go to chattadata.org and just see a wealth of information about the city and how your city runs and operates. That also put into place some governance and structure for it, and it's been kind of growing and evolving ever since then.
Our mission is actually to drive citizen-focused, data-driven solutions to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of delivery of city services, which is a bit of a tongue twister, but we take that data and use it not just out in the public. I mean, obviously, we believe in transparency, putting things out there, but we also try to get departments and divisions to really use their data to kind of transform the lives of Chattanoogans.
Initially, when we launched our open data program, definitely it was a transparency and letting people know about it, but we decided we were going to be some of the first and most active users of that data and thinking about how can we take this data that we're putting out to the public and then also make it actionable and useful internally as well. So it's kind of, we thought we would use our own data in a way that we think we can help Chattanoogans with. So that's kind of the impetus behind a lot of our data-driven work, especially in the early days.
And you have examples from before your time with the city. You have examples to propel this mission, to propel the work that you're doing now. I'm just thinking of Chattanooga's data-driven mission to end veteran homelessness, which received national recognition. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so I think that's a really great model of what a data-driven approach to solving complex problems looks like, in that it started out with not exactly knowing how we were going to do it and not even really knowing how to get our hands around it. And so we started looking at the data and just tracking lots of different things. And eventually we were able to realize that you can almost think of it as like a funnel, getting people from intake all the way down into stable housing. And there's different key components and phases along that way. And each one of those is kind of a funnel point that you have to get through to move on to the next. And so once we kind of saw the whole system and how it operated, we were able to look at those data for each of those different phases and see, oh, well, we're doing great at our intake, but having a hard time getting people to get a voucher, or they're getting a voucher, but having a really hard time identifying landlords who want to take that voucher. And so we were able to use data in a very iterative way, kind of just looking at it, seeing what the data says, and also in a very collaborative way. So we actually had these joint meetings where we would talk about what we're seeing in the data, not just with our program ourselves, but with the city partners as well. And so it really became into using data in a learning stance. A lot of the DNA of our data program, they're very proud of. Some people get very focused on, did we meet exactly this metric or that target? But we're really interested in how we're using that data to learn and grow, because we live in a complex world and deal with people with complex problems. And we need to be able to move and grow with that and learn as things change on the ground. And we do that with our data program all the time. And the homeless services, by taking this iterative learning approach to data, we're able to effectively end veteran homelessness. Now, what that means is basically we're able to take people out once they experience homelessness that's short. We're able to house them in such a way that they are fully housed and that the rate at which they're coming in is not greater than the rate at which we're able to house them.
And this work earned a gold certification from What Works Cities, a national certification by Bloomberg Philanthropies for data-driven cities.
Yeah, the What Works Cities initiative is from Bloomberg Philanthropies, where they try to get cities to be more data-driven. And part of that is a certification where you can kind of see where you stack up against other cities and kind of have this normalized, what does a data-driven city look like? And we applied for it. We used a lot of different projects that we've done here at the city. It's not just us. I think it's the departments that work on it. A great example of a recent project that we included in our submission was with the fire department, CFD Connect. It's a really great program. So Chattanooga Fire Department is very data driven. They noticed in their data there was an increase of invalid assist calls, which are calls for people who maybe they need help transferring from their wheelchair to their bed. Maybe it's putting their socks on. It's a lot of these types of calls where people basically need social services and the fire department is responding. So the fire department noticed this and they partnered with UTC to kind of assign social workers to go out with the fire department and go to some of these frequent users and start partnering with other social services to kind of connect them to the things they need. And this they've done in a very data-driven approach. Started about a year ago and it's still continuing to stay and I think expanding. So CFD Connect is a great program. We have a couple other ones that we highlighted in our application, but I think one thing that struck a chord with us, and I don't think we fully realized it until afterwards, is kind of at the end of this certification, there's also an on-site two-day intensive process where they're talking to departments about their projects, about their data, like what are they doing? And at the end of it, we had a talk with the Well Worked Cities folks, and they say, you know, one thing that really struck a chord with them was a lot of the data-driven projects that the city works on are really focused on improving the lives of Chattanoogans. And it's very user focused. It's not just, here's a really cool use of data and data story. It's more about how you actually use it to change people's lives for the better. So I think that's something that we're really proud of, not just our office, but the city of Chattanooga government as a whole is using data in that manner, not just what we say is like data for data's sake, but more to actually make changes, make real change.
You can see this in even really mundane data projects that like might not connect to Chattanoogans' everyday experience, but really impact their experience in the city. So something is like really boring as the city's time to fill. How long does it take for us to hire folks through the city? The whole kind of why and purpose behind focusing on that in data-driven ways, because when we don't have people in those positions, it has lots of knockoff effects that affect Chattanoogans, right? So people who are left to cover that service are doing double work. So they can't provide the level of service that they'd like to Chattanoogans. They get stressed out and are maybe not giving the best customer experience to Chattanoogans when they engage with that service. Realizing that something that seems kind of boring and very kind of inside baseball about time to fill actually has a direct impact into our mission of serving Chattanoogans and making sure that we do that in a compelling way. So the data work is directly tied to that mission and wanting to serve folks. That's the kind of, we always start with our why when our data work. And that's something that's kind of grounding a lot of our data work. And challenge we have is trying to tell that story. And that's why I'm glad we're able to talk here today, is because, you know, data is very kind of boring. The eyes glaze over when you start talking about data and metrics and spreadsheets and everything, you know. But when you can actually relate it back to like how it's being used to improve people's lives, I think people start to get it. And so that's part of why we wanted to go on the show, is saying, you know, we're a data-driven city, but it's really in service of Chattanoogans, folks listening to this show, so they understand their government's working really hard for them.
You are hiring because you have more work to do. The city has more work to do. And as of now, there's only two of you.
We are hiring. Mayor Kelly saw the value of this work and is doubling down on building a data-driven organization and government. And so we have several positions for people who are curious and want to make a difference in their community. And we're looking for folks who love solving problems, trying to go deep into understanding root causes, have some data chops and analysis. Those types of people I think would do well in this position. It's a lot of fun if you're a curious guy like me. I'm the kid, when I would go visit people's houses, I would go and like go into the rooms and open up closets and things like that. Like, I just want to see what's there. If you are that kind of personality, it's a great job because you basically get to kind of see the totality of government. One day you'll be working with police, but the next day you might be working with our land development office and permits. And another day you might be at the wastewater treatment plant helping them with something. So it's a very varied and interesting position.
This job, you just are very lucky to be able to interact with so many departments and help break down silos and data. For applicants, one thing to look forward to is this future state of like right now, we've taken a lot of the data that's hidden in like the police department, the fire department, code enforcement, public works, all these different sources. And we've started to kind of centralize it. And I think this next iteration that we're going to go through of this office is really getting that data to kind of talk to each other. And that's kind of this future state of realizing kind of what are the collective impact that we're making on Chattanoogans with, and you know, how they interact with the city, and combining these data sets into some really, really incredible uses. And that's that's what I think this next phase is. And also really trying to partner more with nonprofits and agencies in data sharing to kind of help them also be high users of our data. We have a lot of good data out there on the open data portal, but also internally that I think there's a lot of people who could benefit from. And I think that's this next phase that I'm really excited about. And whoever applies for these senior data analyst roles, I'm really hoping that they're excited for as well.
So for people who want more information about the office, for people who want more information about these senior data analyst positions that are now open, where can they go online?
So you can go to chattanooga.gov and our hiring site there, and you should be able to see those pretty easily. If you want to learn more about the office that you'll be working with, you can go to connect.chattanooga.gov/opmod. That's our acronym, Office of Performance Management and Open Data.
You can email us at opendata@chattanooga.gov. We're always pretty quick to respond. Doesn't even have to be about data. Maybe you just want to talk, just email us.
All right. Andrew, Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
In Alabama, T.K. Thorne is an author and a retired captain of the Birmingham Police. Her latest book, which delves behind the scenes of the city's racial turmoil during the pivotal 1960s, is titled Behind the Magic Curtain: Secrets, Spies, and Unsung White Allies of Birmingham's Civil Rights Days, published by New South Books. I spoke with T.K. earlier this summer. T.K., thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
When you were approached to write this book, you had to be convinced. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I was just sitting around minding my own business and found myself in the middle of an email conversation with people I didn't know. I tried to tell them that I was there by mistake, but they insisted, no, wasn't a mistake. And it was four elderly, and I say that they were in their 80s. And some were approaching 90s, gentlemen that I didn't know, but they invited me to come up to an office in a prominent law firm. If they had asked me to go to a bar to meet them, this book would not have happened. But I figured that was pretty safe. So I went, and they told me that they wanted to write about stories that had not been told. I thought they had made the mistake and picked me because they thought I was a civil rights expert, which I was not, at least not at the time.
They turned to you, though, because you wrote Last Chance for Justice about the investigation into the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in 1963.
Well, that's what I thought, and that's the logical conclusion. But that really wasn't the book. It was another book I had written about Noah's Wife, which was a novel, a historical novel. And I was as taken aback as you were. And I said, why that book? You know, what's the connection? And one of the gentlemen said, well, I just read Noah's Wife, and I figured if anybody could make me believe that this was the real story about what had happened thousands of years ago, that was the person to write this book.
Well, let's talk about some of the stories in this book. Most of them are about members of Birmingham's Jewish community during the civil rights movement of the 50s and the 60s. I'm thinking first of Abe Berkowitz, who confronted none other than Bull Connor himself.
Yes, he did. He was a bold man, and he spoke his mind, said what he thought. One of my favorite stories about Abe Berkowitz. In 1962, near the end of the year, the courts had decided that Birmingham's parks and recreation facilities had to be integrated, or at least desegregated. And Bull Connor and his fellow commissioners had decided they would just close the park, pour cement in the golf holes, and close the park or sell them in order to keep from desegregating. So Abe Berkowitz wrote a letter to the newspaper and said, I prefer to keep the parks and sell Bull Connor.
And another story you tell, another person whose story you tell in the book is Betty Loeb.
Yes. Betty was very outspoken. In fact, she made it onto the Ku Klux Klan's watch list for a dangerous person because of her activities.
And those activities were?
Well, one thing she did, she had a radio show. And so she was able to counter some of the vitriol that was being spewed by Klan activists. And in fact, one of them, whose name was Asa Carter, had his own radio show at the time. She was able to gather enough forces against him and what he was saying that shut down his station. But she also did a lot of things that were not on the public radar. She went with other women, black women, to visit the schools in Birmingham, particularly the black schools, which were poor and didn't have equipment, and try to meet their needs as best they could. She was part of a group of integrated women, black and white, who met regularly from the late 1950s into the 60s and on.
And two other people you write about in the book, Carl Friedman and Jack E. Held, both attorneys.
Yes. My favorite story about him is, and Carl was one of the gentlemen who asked me to write this book, and it was his law office at Permute that where I met them for the first time. And he told me to call him Uncle Bubba. He was Uncle Bubba to the whole community. But one of the stories that my favorite story about him goes, you have to kind of jump back to a person who was his law partner for most of their lives. But before that, J. Mason Davis was a young black man who had just graduated from a law school in New York. And the reason he was up in New York is that Alabama, of course, the University of Alabama had a law school, and there were other law schools in Alabama, but they didn't want black people to go to them. So in order to keep from being sued, they would pay for these black people to go out of state to get their education. And that's why J. Mason Davis was in New York. When he came back on his first day, he walked into a fairly hostile courtroom setting. And, you know, I'm sure that people were ignoring him or not happy that he was there. But he recognized two Jewish men that he had known, or his family had known, and one of them was Jack Held and the other was Carl Friedman. And so he went and sat with them. They explained the court proceedings to him, and it became kind of a little ritual between them. The place to go in downtown Birmingham for the attorneys to eat lunch was a Chinese restaurant, but they served whites only, which is pretty ironic. But Jack Held and Carl Friedman and J. Mason Davis would go have lunch together in the basement of the courthouse out of the vending machines. And that started a lifelong friendship between all three of them. In fact, I went to lunch with them. They were still going to lunch in Carl's late 80s and early 90s.
Another person in the group that approached you to write this book, Tom Lankford, a reporter with the Birmingham News, who covered law enforcement in the 1960s. His notes are woven throughout your book. Talk more about what you learned from him.
Well, Tom was really the reason that I got excited about writing this book, because I really wasn't. But he asked me if he could send me the notes to a story about a breakfast he had with his boss. It was the famous Vincent Townsend of the Birmingham News. And I said, sure. I didn't want to be rude, so I said, sure, you can. And he sent it to me, and oh man, I was hooked, because Tom, who is not Jewish, but Tom was kind of behind the scenes for every really significant civil rights event, documented everything with photographs, and he wrote stories. He was embedded with the police department. He was assigned the police department as his reporter's beat, but he admitted himself, he crossed the line of being a reporter and sort of became an embedded police officer. And he was actually the impetus to a lot of secret tape recordings that was going on by law enforcement, both the city and the county, throughout this time period.
And talk about your own background in law enforcement with the Birmingham Police and how it helped shape this book.
Well, I can't say that I always wanted to be a police officer, because that's not true, but I sort of accidentally found it. And that's another story. But I decided to try it. And so I went to the police academy and I spent a couple of decades and worked my way up to captain before I retired. But having that background allowed me to understand a lot of Tom's stories in particular about the police department and being in the police department and understanding their mindset and the policies that they worked under was just helpful, and I think, in making it more realistic.
And your experience with law enforcement through the Birmingham police, that came after this era, which you write about. There are lessons from what you write about and from your own experience that inform this book. What lessons do you think this book offers now?
It's not a simple question, and there's not a simple answer. And there's several lessons that I felt like I learned in researching and writing this book. One of the most significant ones, and it sounds obvious, but it really wasn't obvious until I got into it, and that is, the cost of standing up is not something that I really ever thought about. And these white people who stood up were very, very isolated. And that was one of the, there are many ironies that I've uncovered, but one of them was the fact that I never thought about, which is, and this is not to take one bit away from the Black community and the protesters and everything that they fought for and did and the bravery that they had. At the end of the day, they went home to their communities and they had support. Their family and their community is a support. The white people who stood up were ostracized and isolated. To me, that really, really came home as to how hard it was to do that. And the lesson, I guess, is that you need to be willing to pay that price. It's worth it, but you know, you need to understand that what activists feel today, people have gone through that before in a much harsher time. So that's kind of the main lesson. But there's all kinds of things that have stirred up my thoughts about where we are and how we got here in terms of race relations and mistakes I think we may have made and how we did that.
All right. TK, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots. This afternoon from the stage of the Isis Theater in Asheville, this is Lazy Birds. Lazy Birds is a roots band from the mountains of North Carolina. No less than Doc Watson was a big fan. He said Lazy Birds play a good variety of blues, jazz, and that good old ragtime sound. If you want some good music, he went on to say, have these boys come out and play for you. I guarantee you will enjoy what they do. The band began, according to their website, 20 years ago when guitarist Jay Brown and drummer and singer James T. Brown, who had played acoustic blues and folk together in high school in Birmingham, Alabama, moved up to Boone, North Carolina, where they became immersed in the rich musical heritage of the Appalachians, while at the same time delving deeper into blues and jazz. The other members of the band are Asher Hill on bass and Brad Pope playing tenor guitar and mandolin. We shared the first part of this show with you last Monday. If you missed it, you can find it on the station website. This is the second half of the show, beginning with their take on a classic country blues.
Some place that I've never been before. I'm gone where the water tastes like wine. I'm gone, well, I'm gone, hear me gone, go today. Just exactly where we're going, I cannot say, but we might even leave the USA. There's a brand new game, Lord, but somebody's got to play.
Dooley, he had to put his dog down tonight, and this is for Cletus, his Cletus. Basset hound.
Dooley and Cletus.
Hopefully they're watching.
All come true. May you always do for others and let others do for you. May you build the ladder to the stars and climb on every rung. May you stay forever young. May you stay forever young. May you grow up to be righteous. May you grow up to be true. You always know the truth and see the light surrounding you. May your heart always be joyful. May your song always be sung. And may you stay forever young. May you stay forever young.
busy. May your feet always be swift. May you have a strong foundation when the winds of changes shift. May you always be courageous, stand upright and be strong. May you stay forever young. May you
Cletus.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, y'all. That was Honeysuckle Rose, or Oscar Alemán version there.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, y'all. Augusta Bus Stop's the name of that one. We really want to thank y'all. Always a pleasure to be here with you, and it means a lot to us to sort of almost see you out there. Yeah, yeah. Well, we need y'all. We need y'all even more. But thank you, thank you.
Thank y'all.
Okay, so we'll close with this one.
Louis Prima.
From the great philosopher Louis Prima. This is "Enjoy Yourself, It's Later Than You Think."
Thanks to everybody who picked up a CD, these Brand Hammer new CDs, T-shirts.
They're over there
over here on this table here.
In front of the stage.
We forget to mention.
Yes,
tell
we do.
Tell the whole joke again.
Yeah.
I don't think I can, but
changes every time.
Yeah.
The short version of the joke is it's 2020 and there's two CDs with 20 songs each, and it's $20.
50
and if
cents
you
a song.
Miss out on it, then you'll be kicking yourself.
Because
hindsight is 2020.
Think you gotta finish.
He's got it, boys.
Thank you. You told that so efficiently.
Yeah.
Check off all the boxes.
It's not one you can just rush.
No, that's true. It's in F. Starts on B flat, right?
Can we count?
Not yet, because I have to find the right hole. Got it now.
One, two, three.
Enjoy yourself. It's later than you think. Enjoy yourself while you're still in the pink. The years go by as quickly as a wink. Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think. You work and work for years and years, you're always on the go. You never take a minute off, too busy making dough. Next year for sure you'll hit the road, you really get around. How far can you travel when you're 6 feet underground? Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think. Enjoy yourself while you're still in the pink. The years go by as quickly as a wink. Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think. Go to nightclubs, you just don't care to dance.
Oh, no.
You don't have time for silly things like moonlight and romance.
Oh, no.
You only think of dollar bills tied neatly in a stack. But when you kiss a dollar bill, it doesn't kiss you back.
Oh.
Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think. Enjoy yourself while you're still in the pink. The years go by as quickly as a wink. Enjoy yourself, enjoy yourself.
you like lasagna very much. All you do is eat and eat.
I love lasagna.
But you won't eat kakusa. You're afraid it'll break your teeth. You're afraid you might bite off a little more than you can chew. Don't be afraid, you won't have teeth when you reach 92. Oh, enjoy yourself. It's later than you think. Enjoy yourself while you're still in the pink. The years go by as quickly as a wink. Enjoy yourself, it's later than you think.
Lazy Birds from the stage of the Isis Theatre in Asheville. This is Scenic Roots on listener-supported public radio.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.